Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Steal My Heart by Tatum West, narrated by Tor Tom and Alexander Sindiz. Prologue. Gil. I watch as Abingdon's mayor, Bobby Minton, shuffles papers. He glances at his colleagues impatiently, and he seems to be aggressively ignoring me. The buff, imposing cop with rainbow tattoos, peeking out from beneath his neatly pressed shirt sleeves. And today, I'm actually supposed to be the center of attention. People usually aren't in the business of ignoring me. Not really. With the way Bobby and his team are not looking at me, I can safely assume they won't ask all the questions I've gotten the second I set foot in this town again. Do you pitch or catch on the police department baseball team? What exactly does that rainbow flag on your arm mean? Isn't it hard for you to be on the force with politics like that? I guess my sexuality is political to a lot of people in Abingdon, Virginia. Maybe it's my fault that I came back here, that I wanted to try again. I heard it's changed, but judging from the comments I've gotten at the hardware store, it hasn't changed that much. Bobby's got my resume on top of that stack in his hand. They all do. Candace Jones, who works at the town hall with my sister, Fox Lee, the county's district attorney, and Al Van Naren, representing the city council. Together, they make up the search and hiring committee put together to recruit a new police chief for the town of Abingdon, Virginia, my hometown. This is the first time I've been back for more than a weekend visit in almost 15 years.
"Does anyone have any more questions for Gil?"
the mayor asks. Candace shakes her head, smiling. Al has nothing else to contribute. As the silence lengthens, I see Fox glance at Bobby while lifting a finger.
"I've got one more thing," Fox says, peering up at me from his notes.
Fox might be firmly in my corner, but he's also the DA, which means he's got more riding on the town making the right hiring decision than anyone else in this room. If I get the job, he and I will work together regularly. I can think of worse things. He's easy to look at, a genuine silver fox, especially for a guy his age. I bet he spends more time in the gym than I do. He's married to one of my old classmates, Leonardo Nicholas Rippon, voted most creative and best dressed in our class's senior superlatives. Nicky went on to do bigger things than any of us ever imagined he would. I'm still not sure how sweet little Nicky managed to snag a catch like Fox, but it's obviously working for them.
"Go ahead," I respond,
sitting up as straight and squared away as I can, trying to look the part of the small-town cop. "That's why we're here." He nods, sitting back in his chair. He looks cool enough to eat with a cherry on top. I know it's not polite to lust after someone else's husband, and not wise to do so during a job interview, but damn.
"In a town like Abingdon, with such a diverse population, along with all the tourists, we occasionally see conflicts arise between some of the more conservative members of the community and the new people. Given your background growing up here, your experience in the military, and then as a detective in Monterey, do you have a sense of where your loyalties lie in regard to handling such things?"
I suppress the smile that wants to come to my face. I have a very good sense where my loyalties lay, and it's not with the backward Bible-thumping hillbillies who ran this town like their own fiefdom when I was a kid. When my buddy Dylan called me 2 months ago and told me the old police chief died in a bar fight he started by trolling a couple of gay bikers, I, of course, paid my respects. But I also got off the phone knowing the whole county would be a better place. That's what I'm thinking. Instead, what I say is lifted straight out of my introduction to law enforcement textbook. "It's really not a lead officer's role to have loyalties," I observe. "My job as chief will be to set expectations for the force and the community. Those expectations include being fair to everyone, while requiring we all respect one another, follow the law, and if we choose not to follow the law, then we're referred to your office to face the justice system." I give Fox and the rest of them my best can't-rattle-me-deadpan expression. That said, I don't have a high tolerance for stupidity or for entitlement, so I'll probably just piss everyone off. Fox's eyebrows raise. He expected the first part of my answer, but not the second. He nods again. Well, we've got no shortage of either in Abingdon. You'll have your work cut out for you. Another moment passes, and I think I'm about to be done with this interview when Al Van Naren speaks up.
One last thing, he says, relaxing in his seat.
He smiles nervously.
Hypothetically speaking, if you got the job, what's the first thing you'd change in the department? It could be anything, just off the top of your head.
I can think of a few, but none of them are easy to change. It's too soon to start thinking that way. Personnel changes and policy adjustments take consideration and input from the force as well as members of the community. There is something, though.
Uniforms, I say, shaking my head, hardly believing I even said it out loud. I change the uniforms. Excuse me? Al asks, looking confused. What do you mean?
It's far too early to even think of making substantive changes. I'd like to make changes, of course, but I need to get to know the team first. Candace nods, and Bobby sits back in his chair, considering me. I take in multiple perspectives before any big decisions are made. I pause. But the uniforms here are ridiculous. Fox gives a stifled laugh, and a smile that can only mean he agrees with me. Bobby is still giving me that considering look, and Al seems to be biting his lip.
How is that? The mayor asks.
Shiny plastic shoes and blue polyester uniforms with gold-threaded piping down the pants just aren't practical in 21st-century community policing. A police officer needs to be comfortable on the job. It's not about shiny badges on your chest or who's got the biggest duty belt. I'd rather see my people in cargo shorts on bikes patrolling the town than sitting inside an air-conditioned cruiser polishing their brass. Judging by Bobby and Candace's expressions, my reply isn't what they expected to hear. I don't know whether that's good or bad. To be fair, I don't think I care. I'm still not entirely sure why I'm even here. I didn't exactly plan on ever coming back here. It's not like I'm unhappy in Monterey. When the interview concludes, everyone shakes my hand, thanking me profusely for coming and spending a few days with them. They like that I've reacquainted myself with Abingdon and took the time in getting to know about the job I'm in the running for. I don't know what they're looking for in their next police chief. I know what their last one was like, and I'm not him. I came to see if what Dylan said about Abingdon was true, that the town really had changed, that it's no longer a swamp, swimming with backward people and 19th-century ideas of good and evil. Dylan swore the place was transformed, and after 5 days on the ground, I'm inclined to believe the transformation is more than just a pretty veneer painted on for the tourists. The transformation isn't complete, not by any means, but it is happening. Main Street, which was derelict, lined with abandoned buildings when I was a kid, is now busy and colorful, filled with art galleries, eateries, shops, and even a nice used bookstore. The old train station that was a ruin when I left town to join the Marine Corps now holds the title of the Abingdon Fine Arts and Crafts Center. It's got a sculpture garden on the front lawn, where there used to be a pile of scrapped, rusting train parts. There's a big postmodern addition that houses artist studios and classrooms for painting, pottery, and other craft workshops. My mother worked there as the gallery director for 10 years before she died about 6 months ago. From what I understand, the Abingdon Arts Council is about to float a plan to rename the building in her honor. That would be something if it happens. I think my mother played a large part in bringing Abingdon back from the brink of cultural extinction. She deserves the honor as much as anyone, living or dead. After the interview back at my childhood home, I endure one last family dinner with my dad before flying back to California in the morning. My sister Jenny is probably talking me up to everyone on the city council, and she will be for days afterward. She's the head clerk at town hall. Ordinarily, she'd be on the committee herself instead of Candace Jones. I still think it looks like a conflict of interest with Candace involved, but Abingdon is a small town. My family knows or is related to everyone in the area, one way or another. There's no way to avoid potential conflicts of interest, which is the point Fox was trying to make in the interview. He's gay. He knows I am too. He may want fresh blood in the police department. After the last chief, I can't blame him if that's his opinion.
Well, son, if this is what you want, I hope it goes your way.
My father says, between bites of meatloaf and mashed potatoes.
I can't exactly say I ever expected you'd want to come back here. It doesn't seem like it's big city enough for you.
Jenny glares at him. My sister handled everything while Mom was sick, and she's managed to keep Dad afloat since Mom passed. Even she has her limits. She needs help. Dad is untethered. He's lost without Mom. They both need some additional support. Maybe that's part of the reason why I'm here, too. My father's observations are about as much encouragement as I'll ever get from Gilman Preston Steele, Sr. That's his way of saying he's finally, grudgingly, accepted the fact that his namesake and only son is queer. His word. But he just as soon I left that little tidbit back in the Bay Area.
Don't worry, Pops, I say. Odds are I won't get it. And then you won't have to worry about me bringing my big city ways to sweet little old Abingdon.
The big city came to Abingdon a long time ago, Jenny chimes in, grinning at me over her iced tea. Daddy just ain't caught up yet. Doubt he ever will.
My father and I never had a close relationship. I was an astounding disappointment to him from the day I uttered my first word. Football.
He's the dean of academics at Virginia Highlands Community College, a lifelong academic who holds dual PhDs in philosophy and education. He couldn't believe his only son turned out to be a jock who flunked history and liked boys. He wanted me to be a junior version of himself. It didn't work out that way. He blamed my mother, until he blamed me.
I can't tell you how much help you've been this week, Jenny says after dinner, while we clean up the kitchen. And I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to having you back home. Dad's a gruff old bastard, but he's been brighter this week since you've been back. I know it's hard to see, but you've improved him.
I love my sister, but she's right. It's hard to see my father as much more than a dark cloud, looking down on me disapprovingly.
You're going to get the job,
she assures me, straightening my collar before I head out.
I know it.
Jenny, my sweet little sister, was and will always be the most optimistic person I've ever known. I kiss her on the cheek. I'll be back here in a few hours. I'll make sure Dad gets tucked in, and I'll call you once I'm back in Cali tomorrow. Give the kids my love. After giving Jenny my goodbyes, I swing over to the fire station for a final check-in with Dylan. He and I were best friends in high school. By the time we were deployed Marines in Afghanistan, we were a whole lot more than that. We were young, scared to death, far away from home, and together, we figured out a lot of shit about what it meant to be gay, from the purely mechanical to all the other bullshit. After our deployment concluded, he went his way and I went mine. But we stayed tight. Dylan is the only really true friend I've ever had. I love him like a brother now. But once upon a time, it wasn't brotherly love we were exploring.
You'll get it, Dylan assures me. You're a shoo-in.
You should see the other guys they've interviewed. Dinosaurs. Every one of them.
I don't share his confidence. Whatever you say. I reply, smiling, settling in on the worn pleather couch that's been in the lounge of this fire department since I was 16 years old. I feel a broken spring poke me in my ass, and it reminds me vaguely of making out with Dylan on this very same couch when we were in high school, and he was a volunteer fireman pulling the overnight weekend shift nobody else wanted. Those were the days. My dad's not thrilled about the idea of it, I admit. He's scared to death of everybody in town figuring out his namesake's a queer. Dylan smirks.
The only people who matter already know it, he reminds me. The rest of them can get fucked if they don't like it.
Everyone on the hiring committee knows it except Al Naren. Not sure what he'd think. Pretty sure I don't care.
What time's your flight?
Oh, dark 30, I say.
or at least that's when I need to be in Roanoke to check in. I'm headed back to the house shortly to get to bed early. Tomorrow is going to be a long, boring day. And it is. The flight to Chicago is painless enough, but the 3-hour layover at O'Hare is brutal. I spend my time people-watching, checking out the human scenery and thinking about what it would be like to move back to a place I couldn't get away from fast enough when I was a kid. Living on the West Coast has its advantages. No one bats an eyelash if they see you out on a date with a guy or holding hands in the supermarket. It's a non-issue out there. But the pace is frenetic, and the cost of living is outrageous. The traffic is horrible, and honestly, the rich entitled element, who make up much of the Silicon Valley population, make my skin crawl. There's something appealing about coming back home, settling into the familiar, finding a slower pace. I've been burning the candle at both ends since I was 18 years old, and truth be told, crowded gay bars and easy hookups don't hold the attraction for me they once held. The idea of being close to family and old friends offers an appeal I never appreciated when I was a teenager. Chomping at the bit to get away from Mom's apron strings and see the big bad world. I've seen the big bad world now, from the caves and rubble-strewn villages of Afghanistan, to a few years working with peacekeeping forces in Syria, to the gang-owned streets of the Tenderloin. I've seen enough to make me appreciate a quaint small town in the western corner of Virginia, where the worst thing I'm liable to encounter is an errant meth lab blowing up in someone's trailer home. When I was 16 years old, I hated Abingdon. I hated the narrow-minded conservatism and the fact that kids like sweet little Nikki got ridiculed and bullied to the point of breaking. I was a jock and popular, and no one ever suspected I was gay. Dylan and I managed to escape the worst of what this community could dish out to kids who didn't fit in. But we saw it firsthand. We lived in fear of it. We knew just how bad it would be if anyone ever found out. It amazes me that Nikki ever came back after everything he accomplished. One day, I'd like to find out why he didn't. I know there's a story there. We've all got our stories. My first few days back are typical Monterey true crime. Abingdon would be a relief from this grim work. It's amazing the cruelty and viciousness humanity inflicts on itself. A week passes after returning from home, and I find myself immersed in the grind of my general routine, having put aside hopes of escaping back into a world of rising mountains and flowing lakes. Abingdon, my hometown, with its tree-lined streets and eccentric Main Street, seems a universe away from the concrete horror of Bay Area detective work. When the phone rings, my head is deep into the forensic pathologist's work and photographs of the corpse we found in the dumpster. According to the report, she's been there 3 days and died as a result of strangulation. "Steele," I answer, not bothering to look at the number. "Hello, Gil." A vaguely familiar voice pops on the other end of a scratchy long-distance line. "Hope you're doing well. This is Bobby Minton. Do you have a few minutes to talk?" I peer down at the photographs of the girl from the dumpster. She's broken and bruised, with insect larvae crawling on her skin. "Hey," I say brightly. "Sure, I have time." "Well, I'm calling to offer you the job," he says. "It was unanimous. We'd like for you to be Abingdon's new chief of police. The compensation is just as we discussed while you were out here. Plus, we've thrown in a relocation package that should cover any expenses you incur with the move. My sister is a realtor in town, and if you like, she can help you find a place. We'd like to get you here as soon as possible." Holy shit. "I'm going to email the paperwork for you to review. I hope you'll accept." Holy shit. I put down the photographs, turning them face down. "I accept," I say. "Send me what you've got. I'm really looking forward to the job and to coming home." "That's wonderful," Bobby says. "I'll tell everyone. We're looking forward to having you here, probably more than you realize." Up until this point, I hadn't allowed myself to think this was possible. I'm good at managing my expectations. I didn't let myself think about just how much I wanted the job or how much I wanted to go home and be near family and friends. It didn't seem plausible, and so I pushed it to the far recesses of my mind. I'm going home. I'm going as the town's chief of police, and for sure the first gay one in history. I don't know what it all means, but I know for damn sure the department is getting new uniforms if it's the first and last thing I accomplish in the job. The Barney Fife days of polished brass and shiny shoes are a thing of the past. That'll just be the start of all I have planned for my old stomping grounds. There's a new chief in town, and I'm going to make it my own, on my terms. Abingdon still has growing up to do, and I'm going to make sure that it gets done my way.
Chapter 1. Kendall. Buskerfest is, without a doubt, my favorite event of the year. Abingdon comes alive, and that breaks out the crazy element. It's like someone opened the gates to Dante's Second Circle, and all the inmates invaded small-town Virginia, dressed in Technicolor. There are legions of drag queens doing highly choreographed dance routines, and scantily clad jugglers riding unicycles, eating fire on the sidewalks. My personal favorites are the acrobats, contorting their bodies and swinging from heights that would scare the hell out of me. Sadly, I only catch a glimpse of any of the fun, as Buskerfest is also one of my biggest money-making festivals of the year. People have to eat, and I'm in the business of keeping them well-fed. I serve up steaming bowls of gumbo and jambalaya, spicy steamed clams, jerk pork, and steaming fried plantains. My food truck, Dirty Hot and Sweet, is popular among the locals and tourists alike. The locals rarely see anything like fresh shrimp or shellfish this far west, and the tourists appreciate a departure from the standard fare of funnel cake, fried pork rinds, and barbecue. "Boss, we need more rice," Christos says, pointing to the stainless steel pan that's only a third full. It's 2 o'clock and the big lunch rush is past. Things will slow down until the late crowd starts showing up around 6. "A half batch," I say. Rice is cheap, but it's not good when it sits in the pot, steaming too long. When I turn back to the order window, I see Dylan Manning and Jenny Steele approaching with a cop I recognize from around town, and another cop I don't know at all. He must be the new police chief who just got hired a few weeks back. He's not what I expect, if that's who he is. He's stunning. Tall, dark, and handsome doesn't begin to do him justice. He's beefcake buff with a determined swagger and long, chiseled jawline. A small shiver runs up from the base of my spine when he turns my way for a moment. Good Lord, I'd climb that tree and swing from his limbs any day of the week. "Hey, Dylan, what's going on out there?" I ask, leaning halfway out the window, folding my arms across the ledge. I try not to look directly at our new chief of police because there's something about him makes me nervous, and a guy hasn't done that in a long time. "Nada," he says, smiling back, tipping his shades up on top of his head. "Just a typically weird day at Buskerfest. The wild is out and about early." He nods toward a gaggle of passing drag queens, all spun up in matching pink metallic hot pants and platinum blonde wigs. "Not bad work if you can get it," I observe, watching them sashay away. "Me, I'm stuck in the kitchen. What can I get you?" While Dylan examines the menu board, I flick my eyes over to his companion again. He's talking to the other officer, so it feels safer to look at him now. My studies are rudely interrupted by Jenny Steele, who steps to the window with a big grin on her face, bouncing on her toes like a cheerleader.
"Gumbo," she says, excited by the prospect, "with extra rice and fried plantains."
"I think I'll have the same," Dylan says. "Lemonade to drink."
The female cop orders next, taking her time. Finally, the dreamy new cop steps up, lifting his shades, revealing a pair of the prettiest light brown eyes I've ever seen. They're deep set and thoughtful, flecked with little bits of yellow and green. I could fall right into those eyes and never look away again.
"Jambalaya," he says, "with whatever you recommend on the side, and a lemonade."
His voice is smooth and sweet, like whiskey-dipped honey whipped up in butter and spread on a hot biscuit.
"How about you take me on the side?"
"The fire-roasted corn on the cob is to die for," I suggest.
"Perfect."
He smiles up at me, batting lush, chestnut-colored lashes. I just about melt into a puddle on the floor of my food truck.
"Y'all grab a seat over at the picnic tables," I say, trying to keep my chill from bursting into flames. "I'll bring everything out to you as soon as it's done."
I watch the foursome wander off, hauling in a deep breath to stop my head from spinning.
Then I catch sight of his ass, and I almost hyperventilate. Jesus! I never lose my shit like that. Not anymore, anyway. And never over a straight guy. That guy, as pretty as he is, with that perfect buff build, tight ass, and square shoulders, looks more like a Marine than most cops I've ever seen. Guys who move like that, who look like that, are always straight. He must be here to keep an eye on the crazy folks here at Buskerfest. Just as I'm drooling over his remarkably perfect rear end, he turns and glances back, catching me looking. I expect him to look away or even scowl, but instead he grins, a little deviously. Oh, shit. Could he be... Put extra sausage in the jambalaya, I tell Christos, handing him the order slip, and pick out the biggest best ear of corn. Slather it with hot butter. I make the lemonades while Christos pulls the food trays together. When everything's ready, I pull down the window, turn off the order sign, and tell Christos to take a break. I head out the back door with the tray stacked with food and hope eternal for a short-term improvement in my love life. My dream cake officer and his female cop companion are dressed in the new police uniforms everybody's been gossiping about. Nicely fitted khaki utility pants with lots of pockets, a black short-sleeved polo shirt, black high-top cross trainers, and a lot less gear hung off their belts than the old uniforms sported. It's a heck of an improvement over the Mayberry Police Department look of the old uniforms. And I wonder if this fashion update was Dreamcake's idea, or if I should thank someone else for putting his fine ass in those snug khakis. Here we go, I say, coming up behind Dylan, laying his gumbo platter in front of him. They're all talking when I come up, but quickly forget the subject when food appears. My cooking has that effect on people. I serve them, then plop down in a free spot beside Jenny. Y'all don't mind if I take a break with you? I ask, settling in with my extra-large iced lemonade. It's hot in the truck this time of day, and I need to get out for a bit.
Not at all,
Jenny says, smiling at me, then nodding toward the female cop.
You know Carrie Jackson, right? Our assistant chief of police?
I've seen you around, I say, offering my hand across the table with a big smile. Kendall Vincent, chief cook and rice pan washer at Dirty Hot and Sweet.
Nice to meet you, Kendall,
she says.
Your gumbo's great. Better than I had in New Orleans.
I grin. Ah, shucks.
And you probably haven't met my brother yet,
Ginny says.
Gil is our brand new chief of police. Just started on Monday. We're showing him around Buskerfest.
I offer my hand again, crossing the table. Kendall Vincent, I say, smiling. His grip is firm, strong. He's got big hands. I flush with warmth. Good to meet you, he says with a smile. Welcome to Abingdon, I say, trying to quell my nervous energy. But I guess you must have lived here at some point. Where'd you come from? Bay Area, he says. And I can't tell whether he's looking at me or not due to his shades. Monterey. Wow, I reply. I didn't think anybody ever left California once they made it out there. You must have been really homesick. Gil shakes his head, snuffling a small chuckle. Not exactly. Jenny laughs out loud.
Homesick my ass, she says. We all had to beg him to come home. My dad accused me of bribing the search committee.
I still think you might have, Gil mutters between bites of andouille sausage. No other explanation. Well, for what it's worth, I like the new uniforms, I say. They look sharp.
Thank you,
Carrie pipes up.
Some of the guys in the department are grumbling, but they're so much more comfortable than those polyester monkey suits we had for years.
The only guys who are grumbling are probably the ones with beer guts who can't hide them under a giant duty belt anymore, Dylan observes, smirking between sips of lemonade. We had the same complaints in the fire department when we changed over from dress uniforms to utilities and polos. It sent a bunch of fat guys back to the gym. We'll be getting to that part soon, Gil replies, nodding at Dylan. Carrie and I were talking this morning about a new fitness program. He smirks at Carrie. That's gonna go over about as well as a booger at a Baptist convention. Shit, he didn't just say that. Dylan, Carrie, and I snort with laughter. Jenny looks around at us, confused.
What's a booger?
She asks.
I don't get it.
Everyone laughs again, including Gil. I lean into her ear, whispering gently. It's an unexpectedly attractive drag queen. I'm saying that as nice as I can. Jenny rolls her eyes, shaking her head.
Ugh, I should have known.
But it's a great image, I reply, grinning at her. I don't know Jenny well enough to casually ask her if her drop-fucking-dead gorgeous brother is gay, single, and willing to let me explore his gorgeous body with my hands. I only know her from town hall,
where she helped me get my food truck permits.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?